I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. I have a returning guest, Michael Wright. He was my guest in January of this year, and he is back to talk about theopoetics with me in practice. This is on the heels of Khaled Keith Perry's conversation with me, where we talked a lot about the theory and history of theopoetics, but I really didn't get a chance to dive deeper into actual art and what does it actually look like when we converse about theopoetics, when we discuss it, let alone encounter works that way. And I thought one of the best people I could talk to who would appreciate this and could dig in deeper with me and present some art that we could talk about would be Michael Wright. So thank you so much for joining me today, Michael.
Absolutely. Thank you for letting me be a part of this.
So for people who haven't heard of you or heard the other episode, describe yourself a little bit to the people listening.
Sure. So I am really interested and have been for many years at the intersection of spirituality and religion and art and psychology and kind of where all those things converge. And I've kind of been blindly searching my way through all of this stuff and discovered the Brim Center of Worship Theology and the Arts at Fuller Seminary, and I did a master's degree through them on theology and the arts. After that, I am now working at Fuller Studio, which is kind of the narrative arm of Fuller Seminary, and I'm the associate editor there, kind of helping tell the story of Fuller and share resources for the wider public. And in the midst of all of this, kind of backed my way into a corner and discovered theopoetics, and I'm very, very new to that world, but the little I've read, it's been interesting. It kind of puts language to things I've already been discovering and excited about in the arts, kind of as a site of reflection that's beyond just linear or rational thinking. So
that's kind of what I felt like too. When I encountered theopoetics in an academic way, I thought, oh, there's actually a background and a language for all this stuff that I've been encountering, but never really realized there was a scholarly backbone to this.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so for people who didn't hear the other episode that I'm referring to, do you have a nutshell for what you think theopoetics is in your opinion?
Right now, and I'd love to do more reading, especially of Khaled's work. And when I think of theopoetics, what I imagine is or theology, words about God, theopoetics, poetry, making. I think of the difference between like a single thread that's laid out on a table or like a ball of yarn. So like theology is linear thinking. It's linear. It's using words to trying to describe these immense realities that are beyond the words that we use. And so theopoetics comes in and kind of shakes things up and expands our thinking into kind of a three-dimensional space where there's a lot more that's allowed in that space. So theopoetics is like a way of approaching questions about God and the world and ourselves that creates space for us to disagree, to have multiple viewpoints, to think expansively and open-handedly. That's kind of what I think of when I think of the word theopoetics. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I love about encountering theopoetics is that there's an embodiment to it, and it can involve all the senses, and the way we interact with art is usually transcendent of words, so that you're not locked into how does this fit with text and how can I understand this through language and textual ways, but art can encounter our whole sensibilities in completely transcendent sorts of ways.
Totally. And art as a language of expression kind of helps us maintain a sense of integrity for the whole self. Mm. You know, like words kind of pin things down, and unless it's poetry or some like really deep prose, it leaves a lot of thought out. It leaves a lot of meaning out. The minute you say one thing, you've lost a whole lot of the rest of the world. And so like theopoetics, you're saying many things at once. And that's this beauty, that's what Rumi was saying. We, you know, shared this quote earlier. beyond ideas of right and wrong, there's a field and I will meet you there. Like theopoetics and these different art forms that we are drawn to, those are expressions of that same field where it's non-dualistic and it's embodied and it's beckoning us to more and more reflection and greater intimacy with each other and the world and God. And, that's so much more thrilling and interesting to me than a few.
Yeah. And we're going to be talking about some poetry that, not sure if it's just going to be one poem, but poetry is kind of that borderland where there's sparse use of words, but the imagination is ignited and there's a lot of breathing room to find meaning and metaphor. And it's really enlivening. I love that about poetry and this artistic way it's done so that we can encounter other things. And I guess along with that too, theopoetics allows for relationship, like you just alluded to a little bit, but that piece is actually a real life's breath to theopoetics, because besides relationship with the divine, we can encounter each other in theopoetics, whether it's enjoying and appreciating art together or music, a performance, we're in it together.
Totally. I mean, I remember just more recently, the past 6 months, I feel like I've really grown to understand more of the experience of African Americans in our country because of seeing the movie Get Out or Kerry James Marshall, his exhibit at the MoCA here in Los Angeles. This beautiful, deep, symbolic expression of the Black experience in America in this really open-handed way that I look at the art and then I felt after leaving that exhibit, I just felt like I can see the stats, you know, I can read the tweets about Black Lives Matter, but then I go to this art and like, I feel like something transferred and I began to understand the spirit of that experience in a new way. That's what art is capable of doing. I think it's really beautiful.
So what things do you have to share with us that we can go over? And I will mention too, that the show notes will be full of links and when possible photos or excerpts that you can encounter this, not just through audio, but through other means as well. What do you have to share with us today?
So I have gathered there's a poem and there's an installation piece that we could talk about, or there's also a performance venue that was created by a guy who does social practice, kind of installation art. So is there one in particular you feel like you'd love to talk about? Or?
Well, we can talk about, they're all really good. I really appreciate them. I looked at them all too. We can start with Wolfgang if you want.
Let's do it.
Okay.
I'm so glad that I get to talk with you about this, because I have been, my wife is tired of hearing about Wolfgang. We've actually, my interest in this artist has led to a 2-week-long discussion with the both of us about the meaning of art and how we interpret things. And it's been really, really fun. But anyway, so this artist, his name is Wolfgang Leib or Leib. I'm actually not quite sure how to say it, but Wolfgang is a German artist who, and the piece I would love to talk to you about is called his Milkstone. So you can look those up. You can see people pouring the milk. You can see photos of him online if you just search Wolfgang Leib Milkstone. So he spent many years studying to be a doctor, and towards the end of that time realized that he didn't want to do that, and actually what he wanted to do was be an artist, and he felt like being an artist would be a better way to respond to the human condition. So the Milkstone is his response to his education, to his experience of India and traveling there, his interaction with Eastern thought and mysticism. And so he made this Milkstone. So what it is, it's a marble square. There's different sizes he makes them, but it's a marble square with a small indention. And in that indention, he carefully pours milk until it covers the surface and connects with the marble. And so it becomes one piece. And the more I just sit and look at that image, the more it offers. he's so in the Milkstone, he is uniting a lot of different he's uniting opposites in the Milkstone. So you have the marble itself, which is a solid, and you have the milk, which is a liquid. So you already have these two opposites there. Mm-hmm. You also have a different experience of time. So the marble is this something that lasts many generations beyond a single person. But the milk, it's changed out every single day. So when he installs a Milkstone into a museum, he pours it the first time, but then it's the responsibility of the museum to replace it every single day. So you have this long stretch of time, and then the daily stretch of time on top. And then on top of that, you have that ritual of pouring. It's a contemplative process. It takes probably 15, 20 minutes to pour the milk, to fill very carefully the entire stone. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, what did you think of when you saw some of this?
Well, I was pretty surprised that he ended up there. I wasn't expecting him to go, because first, and people will see this when they link to the piece with him, because first he is doing something kind of extraordinary with pollen that he's collected for like 15, 18 years.
Yeah.
I was like, what? Like, he's just the most patient man,
an
artist I've ever seen. Like, he has this one kind of pollen. He gets a teeny tiny amount every year. And finally, he can make this gigantic rectangle in this space once. And it took him 15 years or 18 years or something to gather all this pollen. And I mean, of course, the first thing I'm thinking of all these weird thoughts, like, what about the people with allergies? What if someone sneezes and blows it away? What if the wind blows something? And it's so temporal, and it's so delicate, and it's so common. Pollen is so common, but yet it's so hard to gather. There's just so many things wrapped up in this. And no one thinks, you know what would make good art? A bunch of pollen in a room. Like, no one thinks that, right? But it's so laborious that he's just tapping away at this strainer carefully, like those Buddhist monks who do the mandalas, you know, with the sand, if you've ever seen it. It was so reminiscent of that. And so it's like this, it's again like a spiritual practice of this carefully sifting the pollen onto this giant rectangle in this room. And the care that it takes, the care that it took to gather the pollen, it was kind of mesmerizing to watch.
It is mesmerizing.
Yeah. And you're thinking, my goodness, this guy is like an artist monk, and the way he talks so quietly, I was transfixed.
I have been too.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
And it was just, I was awestruck, really. But I couldn't, like, it takes a while to wrap your brain around. You're sitting there, you kind of have to be contemplative to get where he's going with it. If you're glib, like, you'll miss everything. You know, if you're thinking, oh, that's weird, I don't get it, you know, you could easily just kind of rush by. Like, but if you're really taking your time with it and you're thinking about things like seasons and time and taking your time and contemplative practice or paying attention and all those things that it takes to make his art, you can kind of get into the spirit of how he creates it and what he's trying to do and what he's trying to say about the created world and paying attention. And it's pretty transformative in just the way you approach it, I think.
Absolutely. And I you know, the Milkstone and the pollen fields are very similar in that way. Like, milk is a sustaining thing that's at the very beginning of life for every human being. Milk keeps us alive. Pollen, in the process of pollen and the way bees move from plant to plant, is a substance, a pure substance of, like, the essence of life. And so he gathers these substances and presents them. It's not just like oil paints that then represent some other scene. He's actually distilling some of the most fundamental parts of life in his ritualistic artistic practice and presenting them to us. And then the more we sit with it, the more we are invited to have that same kind of deep intimacy with the world around us. Like, that's amazing. He has another piece. he has these beeswax rooms where the walls and the surface, every surface is covered in beeswax. And then you walk into those spaces surrounded by the beeswax and the pungent smell. And it actually kind of references or resonates with icons and the gold background of icons. And in those images, those ancient religious images, the men and women are surrounded by gold leaf, and they're surrounded by the very substance of life, filled with meaning, filled with the grandeur of God, you know, as Hopkins would say. And it's just saturated. They're saturated by it, and they're in it. They're in the world. And I think that's one of the gifts that this artist can give to us, is in our detached lives, where many of us are living in cities or living surrounded by screens, where we feel detached from our own bodies, detached from our neighbors, detached from the natural world around us. He's quietly inviting us to reconsider, like, you know, his art starts in contemplative practice of just walking through the fields and interacting with it in a really deep, attentive way. And, like, you know, I look at the Milkstone and I look at the pollen field and the beeswax rooms, and it makes me want to put my phone down and learn the names of trees and take deeper breaths and remember that I have a body, and really, like, for me personally, mind the Christian tradition for monks and saints and theologians who talk about the body and what it means to live in the body and live in the world. And I it's weird thinking, like, here's this man pouring milk on marble. Like, that's dumb. Like, well, no, it's not. Like if you sit with it, like, you'll start, your mind will start going to those places that he went before he made that piece.
Yeah, because he's talking about marble that's, like, it's local marble, I think, right? Mm-hmm. Was it local marble? And how long it's actually been there. And then you're taking something that, you know, is for a baby cow and, you know, gets milked every day and all this. Mm-hmm. And there's this contrast, this juxtaposition of this life-giving thing and then this solid thing. It is really strange. Like, it sneaks up on you because at first you're like, well, okay, yeah, I get it. It's this. And then you're, like, invited to be more careful. Like, he's a very careful artist. And
yes,
very disciplined.
Yeah.
And you're invited by his manner to kind of, in a way, be more incarnated in your life, like a more incarnational experience with life. And that's like holy ground. It's really interesting because not every kind of artwork will invite you into that. Some will invite you into joy or exuberance or shock you or make you really think about injustice or, you know, make you angrier. Art does different things. And this one is kind of like, it's almost like, shh, you know.
Yes. Yes.
And it quiets you down, and it's like, you know, do you know what you're seeing? Do you know where you are? Do you know what this is? And look around.
It seems like, in fact, there's at the Broad Museum here in LA, there's a piece called The Infinity Room, where you walk in, and it's this cube with mirrors on all sides and LED lights that are kind of hanging, brightly colored, different colors, and there's water as well. When you walk in, it feels like infinity. Like, you can look all, you know, like when you're a kid and you look in between, like, two mirrors that are facing one another, you're like, oh, wow, you kind of see down the corridor of the mirrors. Mm-hmm. It's that kind of sense. But I went to it and I experienced it, and I'm like, this is not right. This is something about this doesn't feel right. And as I sat with it, it's so manufactured. It's LED lights. It's mirrors. It's it's like an infinite mirrored room where, like, Wolfgang is, like, inviting you to go outside, you know?
Yeah, with very natural things. Yeah, there is something really, I kept thinking, what would it be like to be in the room with all that pollen? It's so yellow. It's like as yellow as the sunshine, you know? And I was also kind of wondering, because this is, I'm always, like, nerding out. On the one hand, I'm getting, like, enraptured. And on the other hand, I'm like, wait a minute, did all those flowers die because they weren't pollinated yet? <It's>
like, right.
Were the bees like, wait a minute, where's the pollen?
Yeah. Are there a bunch of bees? Is the bee problem in the world because of Wolfgang taking the beeswax?
But it was really astonishing because the deliberateness and the care, and that glass house. Like he lives in a glass house. This will be in the video for people to watch too. But his parents were influenced by a neighbor, I believe, and helped them build this glass house that they lived in. And then they got rid of the furniture, and it's very sparse and very tranquil in there. And you can tell he's very quiet in there and looks around and absorbs all of the beauty of the farmland. And it does make you slow down a little bit, stop and go, I wonder if I could ever quiet down at all like that.
And it's a different kind of, the space is a different kind of minimalism than the popular minimalism of like really fancy homes these days. Like I saw a great article about the wealth it takes to achieve fancy minimalism in your home. And this kind of minimalism actually feels different. It feels more, like you're saying, it's more monastic, it's more austere. It's not about like some pure aesthetic experience in as much as it is about creating a space that allows the mind to stabilize and extend outward and through the glass out in this beautiful field around him. Like it feels more religious in that way, like more like closer to the Zen garden than a popular minimal home.
Like he didn't go IKEA with it. It's just actually
right. Minimal. Right.
Well, what did you think about the egg?
Oh, the egg is so interesting. Oh, so it's that was the first thing he did. Milkstone was the second, and the pollen field was a little bit after the milk. The egg was so. There's two eggs in the world, as far as I know. There's one in his house. There's the first art piece he ever did, and there's one at the forgive me if it, I don't know if it's actual temple or like some kind of shrine, but where Rumi is buried, there's a red egg that he made that's there, and there's one in his home, and he made it like in some cosmologies the egg is the beginning of all things. It's not like water, but it's the egg. So I don't know. It'd be easy to look at a piece like that and dismiss a person for making it. But I love it. Like I have a couple of stones that are meaningful to me. Like one, a therapist gave me, and others that I've collected at different times, at different seasons. And he's clearly, it took him months and months to make that egg. So it's clear that the practice of that, the ritualistic daily practice of slowly wearing this rough-hewn stone down to this gorgeous egg was this embodied, I want to say just an embodied prayer. Like, what is the meaning? He was making it at a crossroads in his life. Like, am I going to be a doctor? Am I going to be an artist? And when he finished, he knew what he was going to do with his life. So there's something really embodied about that, something very contemplative about it. Like, I think it's great. I don't know.
Yeah, it was like his own birth. It was his own origin story, really.
Yeah, that's well said.
And I was thinking when it was in the room, I thought it was a chair or something when they were, you know, you could see into the room. And then he was referring to this egg, and it didn't look like a chicken egg, so I wasn't making a connection there. And so and then they're like, the egg. And I'm like, oh my gosh, he made that? Because it would have taken so long to carve all those curves. That takes forever.
By hand.
Right. That just takes forever. And I don't think people who haven't worked with materials will know that unless you've tried to work with materials and get it that smooth, get something that's stone and make it round. It would take an agonizingly long amount of time, and it would wear you out. Like that stone would beat you up.
Yeah, totally. It sounded like, I mean, you can imagine the angst he was having in sorting out what he believed about the discipline that he thought he was preparing for and this art practice that he was wondering if that was his future. Like there's a lot of, clearly there's a lot of struggle on that decision. That is like kind of, it was around the egg before the egg came to be, you know?
Yeah. And there's an ascetic there like that, the monastic kind of ascetic practice. Like you, I kind of expect him to say, I only eat rice. I only eat rice and water. But because he's so such a purist like that, he just kind of drills into something and sees it all the way through. And it's kind of a punishing discipline, but it's also very pure and beautiful. So yeah, he's a really interesting guy. I'll have to I'll try to look up more links to him and get all that situated for everybody to dig into him more.
Yeah, I would just suggest that one of the best, I think, for your audience, I think people would really love the essay over at Image Journal. Mm-hmm. It was by Brinton Good. He wrote this essay called Still Points, The Quiet Spaces of Wolfgang Leib. And it's a long kind of in-depth essay looking at all these things that we're talking about.
Mm. Awesome. All right, I'll put that in there. What should we move on to next?
Why don't we move on to... let's move on to Theaster.
Okay.
So there's a piece by the artist Theaster Gates. It's called Sanctum, which the past year or so, it's really made an impact on me, just kind of learning more about it and researching it and finding... I found within the work just a lot of wisdom for my own life as far as metaphorical. Mm-hmm. I have so many thoughts. It's like all like getting stuck at my mouth. So there's a lot of metaphorical weight in this installation, and it was only like a couple of it was for a period of time in Bristol. Mm-hmm. The piece is called Sanctum, and the piece is a lean-to that he made in the middle of a ruined church in Bristol. It was the ruins of Temple Church. And he built a platform made out of reclaimed materials gathered from the surrounding city. He, as an artist, made a platform for the artists of Bristol to perform for 24 hours a day, 24 consecutive days. Mm. So it was like bagpipes, a cappella groups, punk bands, poetry readings. Like there was even like a Muslim call of prayer. And all of those artists, thousands of them, were given space to share their work for Bristol. And it was, let me see, I have some notes here. He called it, the city. It was a way to engage in quietly restorative work and to amplify the city's unheard voices. So the city had forgotten their own artists, forgotten their own culture. Mm. And he comes in and creates this platform. He calls it like a connectivity apparatus that then reweaves the artists and the community all back together so that they can experience one another. So the artwork, the material is not just the reclaimed materials that made the performance possible, like the performance venue, but it's also the people themselves. He's working with the entire community to create this. It's torn down, like it's still reverberating through that community for like the rest of their lives. They'll have memories of this experience that shape the way that they view their own city. Like it's beautiful.
And Sanctum is, I like how he said Sanctum is the most holy part of a sacred site, or the most sacred of a sacred site. And so it was neat to see that. Do you know why he picked Bristol of all places?
I don't remember the specific reasons. I do know that there was kind of an artist collective that does a lot of site-specific work in Bristol. I want to say in what I researched, they contacted him in a collaboration. Mm. There's actually an interview with one of the people from that group and Theaster about the work, which is really worth watching. Mm. So I can give you that link.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah. It was interesting because he's a Chicago-based artist, and he usually focuses all his attention in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But I think this is a really successful translation of that same kind of socially focused installation works over in the UK. I thought it was really effective.
Yeah, and it made me wonder, too, the power of art and to reclaim things, and how do we do that in our local communities, or for even just reclaiming things like justice or dignity, or you know, when you think about homelessness or something like that, that sometimes, you know, often we might wind up protesting in marches or something, but sometimes that's not enough lament. And I wonder if something like performance or a chance for people who are suffering to be able to have their own way to cry out in art and performance is actually a more healing salve. Like that, it showed me, like, because there was a sadness to, you know, there's a ruin there and there's a sadness to it. There's something has been lost, but also something that, that there's a remnant too, because there's still all these groups. They're ready to join together and join in for this period of time. So they exist still, but there's something that has been lost too. So I was really thinking about that in the context of, oh, how would we replicate that for different, I guess you could say different incarnations around what's happening maybe in the United States, or what's happening in local places that are, that need to have reclamation.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he's able, if, that I, that language, like the connectivity apparatus, he, through art practices, creates experiences that then wake up communities to one another. It's so interesting. It's just a paradox of our current life, like with so much access to communicating with people on all sorts of platforms. It's also very easy to lose contact with the people that we are bodily around. And the connectivity apparatus that he's creating wakes people up, like in Bristol, like those people are wake up to the local community, which I think is really beautiful. And in an interesting way, because as an, I'm, you know, as an editor for Fuller Studio, I'm always working in digital mediums, not just in physical mediums, media. And I also see in the digital space that it's really easy to forget beautiful things that have been said or written or spoken of, you know, earlier this morning, let alone like a week ago or a year ago or 2 years ago. And so in a way, editorial work is a way of mining forgotten corners of these digital spaces and then like bringing that back to life and making sure we don't forget the beauty that's happening in these spaces too. Like, I don't think it necessarily, I don't think it only has to be bodily, although I do think that's in some ways more important or more valuable. Yeah, I don't know. I just, that's kind of where like his piece gives me a lot of metaphorical language to think about my own work in recovering things that are forgotten and people who may not be celebrities but have beautiful things to say and need a platform to share it, you know.
And it's really like what you do and what he does is you're sort of being woken up and reawakened to something that could be right near you, but you wouldn't know. And bringing it to light and giving it a place to be. But I love the idea that artists can uniquely create a sense of place. I love that about what he did, because no one was going to no one was going to meet in that ruined church, but he made a place, and then that place became alive and full of beauty and full of sound and full of something where all your senses could be awakened and life could get put back into everybody again. And I mean, I would wonder if people from Bristol would go there and just weep, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he has this great quote. Let's see. Materials and spaces have life in them. They have something sacred inside of them that might be sleeping, but it's living. And we have to find ways to activate the living.
Yeah, that's good. Sleeping but living. I think we can turn into those kinds of people too. We're sort of, you know, we're sleeping but living too, because we're just not as aware and not as, you know, doing through the mundane, banal parts of our lives and not really noticing. I mean, that's the job of the artist, really, is like, have you noticed, wake up again, you know, wake up again, everyone, and start to notice. But yeah, I really was enchanted by that little space. And there will be pictures in the show notes and the video that has to do with that. It was a really, I liked how it was lit up. And then there were so many different contrasting performers and all different sorts of things going on in there.
One of the things I love too is the schedule wasn't posted. Like, you can just pick, oh, I really love this person, so I'll wait until 2 p.m. on a Thursday and go see this person. Because I think there's so much knowledge available to us, it's very easy to not be surprised anymore. Mm. And performance is one of the values of performance is that we are in a space together, surprised together, because we don't know what the future is going to be. Like, if I watch a film, I'm less invested than going to theater, because I know in the back of my mind that a film is done, that it's somehow already like frozen in time in a way. But like performance, you enter in a space together and it's like, who knows what's going to happen. So at Songtum, like, you had no idea who you would see. You just knew that if you walk in those doors, you're going to get a taste of the city that you may have not known existed.
Absolutely. And from so many different ethnicities and musical styles, and just who knew? Yeah, this is luck of the draw. You really wouldn't have any clue. But it looked like everything was so heartfelt and so genuine. And you and people, there's something about performance where people are so vulnerable. They're laying themselves out there for scrutiny, or for maybe not, hopefully not for scrutiny, but you know, they're just something about live performance. And that's the thing, when you are behind a screen, it's just different. Like, I really love theater for that reason. Movies, yeah. I love cinema too, but
same, yeah.
It's just so different. When you're in the theater experience, you feel the vulnerability of the actor, and you know they might mess up, and they often will. And every performance will be a little different. I mean, they might not mess up in a huge way, but they might say a line differently the next night. And you feel their vulnerability, and they're trusting you to go with them. And whatever happens, you know, and the show goes on. And at the end, you're kind of like, wow, that was brave. And they appreciate that you appreciated it. You know, there's something you're doing together. And that doesn't happen the same way at all, to me anyway, in front of a screen. It's just different.
Yeah, and it can definitely happen in front of a screen. Like, like that same experience of encouragement, or just that experience of just communion with another person. There are certain films, like, I love the movie About Time. Like, the first time I saw it, it really shook me, and I cried. My wife and I were crying watching it. And it's a romantic comedy, but it's an expression. It's exploring different notions of time and how we need to accept the passage of time. And it's all film, but it takes a lot for film to transfer that same experience. And it takes a lot for me to be available and open to it, watching a movie. But then I think back of, like, when I saw, this was years ago, back in college, I saw Naomi Shihab Nye. She read her poetry, and it was courageous for my department head at English department head of a Christian college to bring this mostly Muslim poet into our space. But in that reading, you could feel the thickness of presence in the air. That you could, she was sharing herself, sharing her poetry in these beautiful, really open-handed and simple ways. But you could feel it in the air, you know. And I imagine that's what people felt in Bristol too.
And being willing to share something of yourself, and maybe it doesn't go well, and you can feel that either, you know, maybe it doesn't go well, maybe it does, but everybody's in it together, and there's something mm-hmm. There's something about that that it does feel like holy ground too.
It's a single shared moment.
Yeah. That's so true. Well, should we move on to poetry?
Sure. So this is one of my favorite poets. She's similar to Wolfgang in that she has a lot of complex and contemplative meaning put with very simple language. So this is Jane Hirschfield's poem, Autumn. Again, the wind flakes gold leaf from the trees, and the painting darkens, as if a thousand penitents kissed an icon till it thinned back to bare wood without diminishment.
Just so much there. Maybe you could read it. Do you mind reading it then one more time?
Sure. I have read this poem for many, many years, and I feel like I learn from it every time I read it or mm-hmm. every time I think about it. Mm-hmm. So again, the wind flakes gold leaf from the trees, and the painting darkens, as if a thousand penitents kissed an icon till it thinned back to bare wood without diminishment.
She is so sparse with her words, but when I was reading that, it helps me anyway to read the actual text, but mm-hmm. Thinking about the golden leaves on the trees being like the gold leaf of the icons, and mm-hmm. It's this really neat crossover of like nature and the sacred. Mm-hmm. I loved it. I love that. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what touched you.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely. Nature and the sacred. You know, this poem is kind of it's simple in the fact that it's a description of two separate images, an icon, or the actions, I should say. There's an icon and a tree. The icon's being kissed by... It's being kissed devotionally, and then the tree is losing its leaves because it's autumn. So you have this image of nature, and then you have this image of a ritual. Those two images, Jane Hirschfield has this amazing short little video about the art of metaphor, which you should definitely watch. And here's this quote I want to share with you. And I think what she's doing in this poem, she articulates in this quote. So metaphors give words a way to go beyond their own meaning. They're handles on the door of what we can know and of what we can imagine. Each door leads to some new house and some new world that only one handle can open. And what's amazing is this. By making a handle, you can make a world. So Jane has made a world out of two images that she lays on top of one another in a simile, this tree losing its leaves and this icon being kissed. And the more I sit with it, the more I learn how important it is to immerse myself in the passage of time and to let that be a holy experience. And, you know, this just that line of like the gold leaf being flaked from the trees and the kissing, it's like inverse image. Usually when we think of leaves falling, I just said it, leaves falling. We think of a negative thing, like leaves are falling away, something is being lost. And then she goes to this image of an icon is being kissed. And over time, you look at old icons from centuries ago, they are falling apart, often because they've been kissed by the very people who are devotionally interacting with them. And that gold leaf is on their lips. And so what is lost? Like nothing is lost. It's just changed. And so it's amazing to me that you could pack so much in just a couple of lines. But I sit with that poem all the time.
Mm-hmm. And I love that she says that it isn't diminished, that mm-hmm. there's nothing lost. I mean, you've also mentioned that. But that's exactly the opposite of what I've always felt about autumn. I've always thought there was a great loss and, oh no, winter's coming and there's this big dead season, you know, and kind of she's redrawn it and she's put new meaning on it and she's made the leaves golden. She hasn't made them dying. You know, there's all mm-hmm. these new ways to think about things. There's all these new worlds that she put into being. And with such simplicity, with such sparse use of words. And she is just a genius at it. And I don't know, like if you took one word out of that, the whole thing would just collapse.
I know. Well, just think about the word again. Mm-hmm. Like just saying again, the wind, that's the first line. Mm-hmm. Again, you know that, oh, this is a cycle. Mm-hmm. Like this is not a one-time moment. Mm-hmm. Like if you take autumn in the context of the cycles of time, mm-hmm. it's not an ending. Again, mm-hmm. the wind flakes goldly from the trees, and again, mm-hmm. soon enough, the leaves will come back and the whole process will start again.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you're still a pretty young guy, but you're maybe getting to a stage perhaps that when you see another autumn come around, that you're like maybe going, oh, autumn again. And I know when I first started appreciating when it starts getting cooler out and the leaves start coming down, usually it would be like, oh no. But there was a time when that switched and I thought, oh, this is actually one of my favorite times of year now. And I would appreciate the change. I'd be relieved. Like you live in a place now where there isn't really seasons changing, but there is something about a change in season and acknowledging it and the passage of time that doesn't feel negative, that can feel comforting and can feel positive. And I think that's what she has done with it. That's the part that's the theopoetic part, is that there's a richness that you can just step into that goes beyond words in such a interesting and full-bodied way.
Yeah, that's well said. And you know, you also have that same, well, it makes me think of a few things. Like one, there's a great song by Tom Waits on his newest album called, I think it's called Last Leaf on the Tree. That's the line of the chorus, like I'm the last leaf on the tree and just hanging on for dear life, like the very last one, like I don't want to die, you know. And so I do wonder, like I wonder how this is an earlier poem for Jane, like in Jane Hirschfeld, like in her earlier book. Like I wonder how she would think about it now. She's many, many decades past when she wrote this. And yes, I am young, and I do think about death often. But I wonder how I'll experience, how I would experience this like 30 years from now if I lived that long. Gerard Manley Hopkins actually has a very similar poem called "Hurrahing in Harvest," where he's looking at autumn and describing the harvest of it as this beautiful expression of sensing the presence of God all around him. And some days I feel that, and other days it looks more like a tree without any leaves, you know?
And I really... I will have these times in wintertime where I go through like a, I don't know, seasonal affective thing. And I have had really bad times in wintertime, really depressed mood and things like that. And it had always been like, you know, really dark, short days, you know, really dark. Mm-hmm. And I thought of it as kind of, oh no, winter's coming. Oh no. And it seems like it's 9 months long. But there was a time in my life, too, where I thought, I wonder if I've been thinking about it in a really unpoetic way, in a really negative way that it doesn't have to be. Maybe the trees aren't, you know, upset at all. Maybe they're just dreaming.
That's great.
And they actually appreciate the rest, you know, that there's nothing wrong at all. They do this all the time. And they're like, whew, summer was hectic. I am just going to dream the rest of this season and look forward to spring again. But, you know, it's funny how we might resist different seasons of our lives that from the outside look a certain way, but that maybe aren't really like that at all. The dormancy is actually a dreaming season.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Do you have anything else or anything we should cover or discuss at this point?
I think just the interest, you know, I was thinking about these three pieces and I was in conversation with one another. And yeah, I think there's something about, whether it's the performance of people in Bristol or the ritual act of pouring milk or collecting pollen, or this poem that's trying to express the passage of time in a tree or an icon, like it's an interesting thread through all three of nature and time, like learning how to be embodied, learning how to experience time, learning how to be more connected to the natural world. I think that's something like, well, there's a Meister Eckhart says that the soul projects itself outward into created acts in order to understand itself. And these are three pieces that have been very meaningful to me. And as they project back to me, I'm realizing like that this is something that's important to me, that I need to learn how to, in the midst of my work online, I need to learn how to be embodied and learn how to be more porous and open to the world around me. And I think it's something we all need to work on, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Even make appointments with nature. I wonder, you know, we're happy to make appointments sometimes with people or other things that maybe aren't even as important as getting back to, like, we are organic. We have seasons and we are organic. We're not machines. And I wonder if it's just good soul care to make sure we get out into the wind and into the sunshine and feel the earth under our feet, actually under our actual feet. And I think that maybe we should make more appointments with nature and feel time passing in a way, like where we've been out long enough that the sun has moved and we've noticed it. But this has been such a beautiful pleasure. Did you have anything else that you wanted to say? I just thought I'd cut you off for a second there.
No, it's fine. Oh. I don't think so.
Yeah. Well, I'm just so happy to know you, Michael. And I just am really grateful that we got to spend a little time going over some of this stuff. I hope maybe we could do it again sometime.
Absolutely. Like I love the conversations that we have, and I hope it's meaningful for your listeners.
Yeah. It's not always, I think there's so many times when we're in a rush, we don't get a chance to just kind of talk about art. It seems like maybe it's an unnecessary thing until you do it and then you realize, oh, I was really thirsty for that.
Totally. And there's actually a great podcast that just started by one of the girls from Broad City and MoMA in New York City. They started a podcast called A Piece of Work. And it's really, really fun. And it's a great kind of irreverent introduction to modern art for anyone who's like really intimidated. It's a great place to start.
Excellent. That'll be on my list for sure. Yeah, the MoMA is so interesting. And people who don't understand modern art, they're just like, I could make that. Yeah. And sometimes just sitting with art, if we're not used to it, we won't give it enough time to kind of seep into us and seep into our bones and allow it to change us. Because that's kind of what's going on. You don't have to understand the entire thing. You could just let it change you.
Totally. And, you know, that's the whole theopoetics. Like, I've been sitting with this stuff by Wolfgang, and I've been sitting with this poem and this piece by Theaster Gates. And I have learned so much about the world and about steps I need to take in my own spiritual practices. Like, I've learned it from them. And it's through their embodied artistic practices where that's where I've learned it, you know. And it's a language that you can learn like any other language. So
I think it's probably the same with music too and music appreciation. You can think, oh, you know, I that's not my cup of tea, that kind of music, but sometimes if you sit with it long enough, you'll appreciate some of the genius of it. And even though you didn't start out liking it, it's kind of, when someone's really good at something, you're really good at communicating a kind of art, you can always develop an appreciation for it. And even modern art, so a lot of people are like, well, if I can't understand what it is, if I don't know that's a dog, you know, if I don't know that's it's just a square on a, but I think that there's something about modern art that is like a presence, and that can be very transformative, and it can quiet us down because there's a lot of reasons to seek out things that quiet us down right now. That would be really helpful for soul care.
Yeah, and it takes courage to do it. There are plenty of times I'd rather not. but Wolfgang's done it a great job of it in his life, and he's inviting me down that path, you know?
Yeah. Well, this has been great. I will, of course, give you a link to this and everything when this goes out. But it's been lovely. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was so fun to talk.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. Just go to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E. patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Remember to subscribe to the show on iTunes or your podcast app, and I invite you to sign up for my newsletter at sparkmymuse.com. I try to send out a message once or twice a month. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.